Today we are counting approximately 13,700 and change.
The absentee ballot counting in the Republican Senate primary begins. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 31st of August. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the state investigates allegations of vote tampering.
It can be accounted to the high tension between the Miller and Murkowski campaign. This is, in political terms, high stakes, but it's an anomaly. This does not usually happen.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by North Rim Bank, helping you get from where you are to where you want to be. Achieve more. North Rim Bank for Business. Information at northrim.com. Member FDIC. And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com. The absentee ballot count today in the Republican U.S. Senate primary shows a slight narrowing of the gap between Lisa Murkowski and Joe Miller at this hour. As of 4 p.m., Miller is leading Murkowski by 1,210 votes, down from 1,668 votes after last Tuesday's election. Thousands of absentee ballots were counted today at the Anchorage office of the State Division of Elections. The ballots are pivotal in the outcome of the race for Alaska's available U.S. Senate seat in the November election. But things were quiet this morning as election volunteers, most of them women, sat at their workstations. Both the Miller and the Murkowski campaigns had sent observers to watch the proceedings. Gail Fanumiai, Division of Elections Director, said ballot counting was taking place at the same time in Wasilla.
Today we are counting approximately 13,700 and change. So that leaves us with almost 2,000 that are in our possession that haven't been counted, plus with some that might trickle in over the next days ahead. Okay, we have about 9,000 questions statewide, and we're counting today about 3,780 plus. So that leaves us with just a hair shy short of 5,000 question ballots that will be remaining to be counted. Of all these numbers, now keep in mind that not all of them are going to be countable ballots. Some will be rejected.
Fanumiai said questioned ballots, those voted on election day but without proper address identification, are verified by a bipartisan review board. Despite fears expressed by the Miller campaign regarding mishandling of the vote count, the operation seemed to go smoothly. Other than a handful of reporters, there were few members of the public in evidence at the division office in Anchorage. When new numbers were posted to the State Election Division website shortly before 11 this morning, the returns showed a slight lessening of the gap between the two candidates in Murkowski's favor. John Bitney speaks for Lisa Murkowski's campaign.
An updated number showing now the gap has narrowed from 1668 down to 1,325 difference. Eagle River and East Anchorage are in, and then as we move later into the day, South Anchorage will come in, and of course we have positive feelings about those South Anchorage districts should be released. So we're expecting this race to continue to narrow throughout the day. We're pretty excited.
The districts reflecting the early returns were in Anchorage and Eagle River. Miller campaign spokesman Randy DeSoto said he wasn't worried about them.
Well, I think that's reflective of the general election results, too. She won the Anchorage area about 52% to 48%. So I think that's the absentees are reflective of her overall vote count here in Anchorage. Yeah, Fairbanks, of course, is Joe's hometown, so that should go well for him. He was in the 60-some percentile up there. Also, the Matsu Valley is where he was in the 60-some percentile. So until we get those numbers, it looks like so far numbers are consistent with what happened at the election day.
Shortly after noon, Matanuska Valley election officials finished counting absentee votes in Wasilla. Those returns lessened Miller's advantage by about 0.1 percentage point. APRN's Juneau correspondent Dave Donaldson is keeping tabs on the returns today.
What we know is it is still a toss-up between Lisa Murkowski and Joe Miller. This will definitely be close at the end of today's count. The fact is, though, there are still votes to count on the Kenai. Actually, quite a few of them. We've only gotten somewhere around 1,500 of them. We were expecting about 5,000 between Kenai and Southeast. No votes yet have been reported from Fairbanks, the interior, and Western Alaska may not even be counted today. So even if Murkowski comes out on top at the end of the day, we're told there are some still 9,000 votes that will be counted on Friday, some more on next Wednesday, and we have no idea where those are from or which primary ballot they will be, whether it'll be the Democratic or the Republican ballots.
Where is Murkowski getting her strongest support?
She saw most of her total increase in the Anchorage House districts, mostly downtown and midtown, pretty much throughout the Anchorage itself area. Miller got a lot of his strength and kept her from getting ahead by taking very comfortably in the Mat-Su. Now, those are the only areas where there has been a complete count so far. These early results show more positive numbers for Murkowski on the Kenai, but that's not complete yet. The same for Southeast. There were only about 700 votes counted so far in Southeast. So, a lot of districts are still pending any recount whatsoever. But it looks like Anchorage has been the best for Murkowski, Mat-Su the best for Miller.
It's number 9,000. I was talking to Gail Finumi-I this morning, and she was saying more like 7,000. Where are you getting 9,000?
I'm going by the estimate of what was put out, and we do expect to see some more stuff coming in time. So it's still going to be well up into the thousands.
Fairbanks, of course, didn't even get started till about 3 this afternoon, so that's expected to boost Miller a bit. What's going to put the final punctuation mark in this election?
I can't imagine that there will not be a lot of challenges and an obvious recount when all the paperwork's been done by the division. Even if it's not within the 0.5% that gives them a free recount, I can't see somebody refusing to pay the $15,000 it'll take to do an entire state recount. So I think that we've got a long way to go. Unless one of them is ahead by several thousand votes a week from today, we can go a long time until we have a party nominee. Meanwhile, Democrat Scott McAdams is hitting the road looking for votes. And right now, as numbers look within the realm of possible, it's going to be an interesting fall, isn't it?
APRN's Juneau reporter Dave Donaldson. The vote counting continues on Friday and on September 8th. By state law, the Division of Elections has up to 15 days after the election to review and count absentee and questioned ballots. Lieutenant Governor Craig Campbell is responding to a complaint by the Miller campaign of alleged vote tampering at the Mat-Su Division of Elections office. An attorney for the Miller campaign, Thomas Van Fline, wrote a letter to the Division of Elections yesterday accusing a Murkowski campaign observer of accessing election information on a state computer. Campbell says the full review of the incident is not complete, but he has determined the security of the voter system could not have been compromised.
The allegation said that he was on a state computer and therefore had access to the state website. And in fact, the Wasilla office where we're doing that does not have the GEMS statewide server system, which is the confidential system that has the ballot information on it. So that system isn't in the Wasilla office. So it's physically impossible for him to have had access to that.
The complaint also accuses the observer of trying to bring a backpack into the ballot observation room. Campbell says that claim appears to be true, but election officials stopped him. The Miller campaign says the observer also tried to use his smartphone from inside the observation room, which is prohibited. Campbell says it looks like that complaint is true.
I believe he did bring a cell phone in, or iPhone or something, and he can, but he's not supposed to use it. And from all indication, he did use it. And he was told not to use it, and he continued to use it. And that will be a problem. But I want to get more details to what was he using it for, who was he sending to. The typical questions to determine what was going on.
Campbell says the full inquiry into the matter should be complete soon. Until then, he says it's too early to say what type of repercussions may be in store for the observer or the Murkowski campaign. He says it's unusual for the Division of Elections to have to investigate these types of allegations.
It can be accounted to the high tension between the Miller and Murkowski campaign. This is, in political terms, high stakes. I mean, this is the U.S. Senate seat and an incumbent being challenged. So I know there's a lot of anxiety in both camps, and I expect that's the byproduct of that was whatever you saw happen or whatever has been alleged happening out at the Matsu office. But it's an anomaly. This does not usually happen.
Campbell denied a request by the Miller campaign to station state troopers at the election offices where vote counting is taking place today. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new center at the University of Alaska will help boost research of ocean acidification.
A lot of times when we go somewhere and make a measurement, it's the first time a measurement for ocean acidification has ever been made there.
Stay ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
$1 million bail has been set for the Hoonah man accused of shooting and killing two police officers. 45-year-old John Marvin Jr. appeared in Juneau District Court today, escorted by a state trooper and a judicial services officer, dressed in red prison pants and shirt, slip-on shoes, and hands and feet cuffed and chained. District Attorney Doug Gardner justified such a high bail amount by saying the shootings of officers Tony Wallace and Matt Ioka was an unprovoked slaying. Marvin also has a record, including a conviction for sexual abuse of a minor in 1993. Meanwhile, Hoonah's interim city administrator Bob Prunella says counselors from Search Behavioral Health led community stress management workshops today at the Alaska Native Brotherhood Hall. He says the counselors are also meeting with people individually as needed.
I know they've already been meeting with a lot of the first responders and there's two chaplains here that are connected to the state police, and they're going to spend the next day. So some good stuff's happening.
Prunella says more reinforcements arrived last night for Hoonah's depleted police force. Yakutat Police Chief John Nichols is doing patrol shifts, and two officers from Wrangell continue to fill in. Wrangell Police Lieutenant Merlin Ellers is serving as acting police chief, while Hoonah Chief John Millen takes time to grieve. Classes were canceled at Hoonah School yesterday due to the police standoff with Marvin, who barricaded himself inside his home after the shootings. Interim Superintendent Charlotte Wright says counselors were available at the school today for students who may have trouble coping with the weekend's violence.
It's important to let kids get into a familiar place, a safe place, and get back into a routine. And then there'll be opportunities to grieve and express their feelings. And we have a good support system for them to be able to have support.
Wright says both officers were involved in school activities. Wallace ran open gyms after school hours and was a volunteer wrestling coach. Tokioka had two children, a 6-year-old son and a 2-year-old daughter. State flags are lowered to half-staff today, and a memorial service is being planned. The University of Alaska Fairbanks has established a research center to gather data and run experiments on ocean acidification. The oceans absorb much of the carbon dioxide put into the air from the burning of fossil fuels, but that removal comes with a price tag that could involve our fisheries. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
The new center at the university's School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences will be run by Assistant Professor Jeremy Mathis, a researcher who last year took samples in the Beaufort Sea that showed higher than expected acidity. Those measurements were not all that surprising. After all, the ocean is colder towards the poles, and colder water can hold more CO2. But they were a wake-up call to scientists. They used to have to bring samples back to a laboratory to get a reading on acidity, but all that can now be done remotely, and the data can be recorded and transmitted. Now they're concentrating on increasing the number of measurements at different places, depths, and times of year. And Mathis says Alaska is an ideal location for the lab and for gathering the data.
We're sort of have the home court advantage in terms of everything is sort of localized. It's a lot easier to do things here than it is from a remote location. It's an Alaskan priority, and so my take on it was the work should be led by Alaskans, people that are living up here.
Much of this is new. There is a small network of buoys taking measurements in the Pacific, including one in the Gulf of Alaska. There's a long tradition of taking ocean samples along a line extending south from Seward, but until a couple of years ago, acidity was not among the measurements taken there. And other than that, the map is fairly blank.
A lot of times when we go somewhere and make a measurement, it's the first time a measurement for ocean acidification has ever been made there.
The pace is picking up. Because of the federal oil and gas leases in the Chukchi Sea, that area is getting a lot of scrutiny. And Mathis is hoping to kick off a program next year that will give fishing vessels a chance to participate.
The beauty of it is that the fishermen are already going to the locations that we want to be in anyway. So what we're hoping to establish is a program where we can send sample bottles to the fishing community and that they'll actually fill up these bottles of water for us and then send them back to me here at the lab, and we'll analyze them for the ocean acidification parameters. And that will give us an opportunity to cover just an incredibly vast area that we otherwise wouldn't be able to.
As word gets out about acidification, fishermen are showing interest. It turns out that different species react differently to higher acidity. Along with accumulating the observations, part of the center's work involves exposing fish like pollock to controlled levels of acidity. And a third element is trying to put all that they learn together into computer models. But Mathis warns it's not going to be an easy process to analyze how fish are harmed by higher acid levels.
That's our ultimate goal, but I still think we're a number of years from being able to make those connections. Unfortunately, the more funding we get and the more attention we can put towards these questions, the faster we'll get there.
Rising acidity, he says, could cause species to shift habitats, changing the competition for food. And the food itself is affected as well. Shell-forming organisms like pteropods are particularly vulnerable to acidity and a major food source for pink salmon, for instance. In the future, as word gets out about ocean acidification, Mathis anticipates there will be attacks on his work from the same interests that now claim that humans are not responsible for climate warming. But he says the science of acid is more difficult to deny.
With ocean acidification, there's no natural process that's making the ocean more acidic. We are measuring an anthropogenic change, and there's really no ambiguity around that.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks Ocean Acidification Research Center currently has a staff of just a few people, but Mathis expects that to grow as they compete for future funding sources in this fast-growing field. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
This just in, new numbers in from the Division of Elections. Joe Miller now leads Lisa Murkowski by 1,469 votes in the Republican U.S. Senate primary. That's a widening of his lead by about 200 votes from where it stood last hour.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering online courses from any location. Fall semester starts September 2nd. Information at distance.uaf.edu.
The battle over state cruise ship wastewater standards has landed in court. A coalition of conservation groups filed a lawsuit last week challenging a state wastewater discharge permit for the cruise ship industry. The groups contend that the state has watered down the discharge requirements set by voters in 2006 and amended by the legislature last year. KRBD's Deanna Garrison has this report.
Earth Justice filed the lawsuit in State Superior Court August 23rd on behalf of the Campaign to Safeguard America's Waters and Friends of the Earth. The suit challenges a state wastewater permit for the industry issued in April. Discharges covered by the permit include water from toilets, kitchens, and other drains. Campaign to Safeguard America's Waters Project Director Gershon Cohen.
We filed the appeal because we believe the state of Alaska has violated the statute that requires them to require the cruise ships to use the best technologies that are available.
In 2006, Alaska voters approved a cruise ship ballot measure that instituted a new statewide cruise ship head tax and stricter environmental standards for the industry. Among the provisions in the voter initiative, cruise lines were required to meet the state's wastewater discharge quality standards from the point of discharge. That meant that cruise ships would not be allowed to use a mixing zone to meet the standards, as is the case with other industries and municipalities. Cruise lines argued that the wastewater treatment technology that would allow them to meet the new standards did not yet exist. Cohen says the legislature sought to address the industry's concerns last year.
There was a compromise bill passed. It extended the timeline for meeting all the water quality standards at the point of discharge, but it did so with the provision that the ships would have to use the best technologies that they can.
Cohen says it's clear to his organization that some of the cruise ships in Southeast are not using the best wastewater treatment technology available.
There are clearly, by DEC's own records, technologies in existence on cruise ships, some of which are being used in Alaska right now, that do a much better job than some of the other systems. And DEC arbitrarily decided that any system that any ship currently has on it will be considered the best available technology for that ship.
The conservation groups tried an administrative appeal of the DEC permit before filing the lawsuit. Merritt Carlson Van Dort is the cruise ship program manager for the State Department of Environmental Conservation.
DEC stands by our 2010 permit. We feel it is both reflective of the legislative intent of HB 134 and is also protective of Alaska's waters and aquatic life. And, to that extent, we're confident that the courts will agree.
Carlson Van Dort says DEC has yet to determine why some cruise lines are able to meet higher discharge standards than others.
Some have been more successful at meeting the standard. Whether they have a better treatment system on board, I can't speculate.
She says that question would likely be left to a state-appointed science advisory panel established to look at cruise ship wastewater treatment technology options. She says a state statute stipulates that any new treatment technology requirement be economically feasible. The Alaska Cruise Association, which represents cruise lines operating in Alaska, is not a party to the lawsuit. Association President John Binkley says the industry is meeting higher discharge standards than most municipalities within the state.
The industry is held to a far higher standard than any municipality in Alaska, and we're fine with that, and we think that's a good thing, and we've invested over $200 million to reach that level aboard the ships that sail in Alaska, and we're proud of that and think it very definitely protects the marine environment. It's water that you can literally drink, almost to a drinking water standard, and that's the standard that we think is a very good one.
The wastewater discharge permit is set to expire after the 2012 cruise ship season. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
A triathlon over the weekend in Sitka raised money for a bike shelter to memorialize Alice McChesney, a longtime resident who died last fall at the age of 83. But as KCAW's Ed Ronco reports, the triathlon, just like Alice, operated on its own set of rules.
Chances are good that if you live in Sitka, you already know this story about Alice McChesney. At 83 years old, Alice had wavy white hair and a permanent grin on her face. She lived on an island, and to get into town, she would row a small boat to shore, then hop on a bike and pedal the rest of the way. She volunteered at the White Elephant resale shop. She played the accordion, and on Friday mornings, she hosted a polka music show at KCAW.
Okay, I'm going to play for you One of Just 20, which I've just been kind of previewing. My brother is such a good musician, and he's on it, and I'm on it, but it's really not set up right.
After Alice died last September, a group of community members, some of them longtime friends, some just longtime fans, started putting together plans to build a bike shelter in her memory. And to help raise money for it, they held the Alice McChesney Triathlon on Saturday morning.
We're going to go over the rules.
First event, playing Oompa-pa twice on the accordion.
Five, 4, 3, 2, 1, 3.
They really sounded quite nice individually. Anyway, from there it was onto the boats to row around a buoy in Sitka Channel. Then contestants ran back up the ramp and to their bicycles.
Okay. Oh, there it is. I think.
Which they pedaled through an obstacle course that consisted of hula hooping, hitting a paddle ball three times, walking the bike across a tiny little bridge, and, wait for it, peeling a hard-boiled egg while simultaneously blowing a bubble with bubble gum. A nice try there by Phyllis Hackett, who afterwards said that was the hardest part of the whole race.
I had to chew that huge wob of bubble gum until the sugar was gone so you could blow a bubble. My jaws are killing me.
Costumes were encouraged and ranged from tutus and striped tights and Mad Hatter caps all the way to Brian Hamilton's full-fledged Alice McChesney getup, brown pants, polyester shirt, wig, and even a pretty good imitation of Alice's smile.
And I just sat next to a mirror and I mastered it. It's a nice, muscly grin, high eyebrows. It's just a very natural smile.
Hamilton was among 28 people participating in the triathlon. Entry fees plus money from a donation jar and t-shirt sales raised more than $1,000. Linda Olson is one of the race coordinators. She says the triathlon got them very close to the $1,200 needed to finish the bike shelter project. Olson never knew Alice, but like so many Sitkins, often saw her at places around town.
She was a phenomenal woman and really such an icon in Sitka. I don't think there's probably anybody that's ever lived here that wouldn't know who you're talking about.
Alice's daughter, Annette Blankenship, says the triathlon was a great way to bring the community together and an incredible tribute to her mother.
And the family will love it. I've got them all t-shirts, and they are just in awe from the East Coast across to the West, you know, because they all know this is happening today. So it's very special.
Awards were given out at the end. Brian Hamilton, with the Alice smile, took second place and won a trophy made of a table lamp with a bike seat mounted on top. Holly DeLand took top honors, claiming a trophy with a big wooden oar attached. And everyone, whether they entered the triathlon or not, took home a smile, which might just be the best Alice tribute of all. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
When we're smiling, when we're smiling, the whole world smiles with me.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly and Matt Miller in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. The Federal Housing Administration's network of FHA-approved housing counseling agencies offers free expert advice to homeowners whose mortgages are at risk, underwater, or in need of refinancing. Visit HUD.gov/Alaska for a counselor near you. This message sponsored by HUD.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.